Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the show that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whomever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. We're continuing our series on the climate emergency and how to design for it, and today I've asked Alex Steffen to join us. Alex is a planetary futurist, journalist, and author, and all-around big thinker. In the 2000s, Alex was the executive editor at the website worldchanging.org, probably the most well-known website of that era on sustainability and how I initially became familiar with Alex's work. The site itself was adapted into two books, both of which have been living on my bookshelf ever since. Alex is a prolific author. In 2012, Steffen released Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Could Save the Planet, a book which explored the innovations and policy changes a North American city would need to become carbon neutral. In 2013, he became the planetary futurist in residence at the internationally regarded design company IDEO. In 2016, Steffen launched The Heroic Future, a three-part series of documentaries on how we might imagine a sustainable future. The series was filmed in front of a live audience over three nights in September 2016 in San Francisco on the theme, You Cannot Build What You Cannot Imagine. Most recently, Steffen has been writing a series of newsletters entitled The Nearly Now, a form of anticipatory journalism that reports from the future. To my knowledge, Alex hasn't actually mastered time travel, but his writings are incredibly prescient, so after the episode, make sure to check back at currystone.org, where we'll provide links to all the aforementioned titles. On the show, you're going to hear about Alex's latest book, due out this fall. He's written The Snap Forward, New Thinking for Winning the Climate Fight, and you'll hear all about it in the interview. But once again, I am running on way too long, so let's get to the show and hear from Alex. Alex, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Alex, I've been a fan of yours since World Changing, and you know, we're going to do a big write-up on the website about all of the things that you've done in this climate space and this design space. But I thought a great place to start would be with, you know, the kind of topic of the moment. I mean, we were talking on the show about the climate emergency, and I think one of the things that we're trying to suss out is, you know, is this something new? I mean, it feels new, right? We've got the youth protests. We've got these declarations of, you know, climate emergency. We've got a personified villain all of a sudden, you know, in the face of Donald Trump. The most powerful person in the world is a climate change denier now. Are things changing? I mean, where's your optimism scale at the moment?
Well, that's a tough question, actually. It's tough because on the one hand, we are seeing a spike in awareness and commitment that we've never seen before on climate. So, you know, not only are we seeing, of course, protests like the school strike or the Sunrise Movement or, you know, the Extinction Rebellion, for example, and not only are we seeing legislative approaches, states leading a resolution for the Green New Deal and Congress, so forth, but we're also seeing corporations, large institutions like universities, local governments, etc., realizing that they have a real need to act now. On the one hand, we're seeing this huge upswelling of awareness and commitment. On the other hand, we're realizing with more and more dire clarity how little time we have left to still secure genuinely positive futures. That with every passing day, we are facing steeper and steeper curves to still be able to avoid really dire futures and get the kind of sustainable prosperity for, you know, humanity that we'd like to see. So that balance between things are getting better, but they're not getting better nearly fast enough is a tough one.
You know, something I've gleaned from some of your more recent writings is that, you know, once upon a time, we thought that we could solve climate issues without a lot of disruption. And maybe, you know, in the 1970s, we could have, you know, it would have been a very small sort of impact on daily life. But we've come to a point where, you know, we can't. Like, in order to fix this problem, we are going to have to disrupt our own lives. We are going to have to disrupt our own cities. There's certain sort of changes that we've been dragging our feet on making, which we might call unavoidable at this point. If you agree, like, what are some of the changes that we need to make right now that you would consider unavoidable, beyond debate?
I would back up one step, first of all, and talk about why solutions that might once have been good enough are no longer good enough now.
Okay.
And that's because we're facing absolute limits right? We're facing, for example, a carbon budget. At any given amount of climate risk that we want to take on, there's a limited amount of carbon that we can emit into the air in order to not go past that level of risk. If we want to keep global warming to a limit of, say, 2 degrees Celsius or even the 1.5 that many scientists are saying we really should stop at, we have an extremely limited budget, which means that since we're still using it up at a very fast rate, every year, the amount of carbon we need to cut the next year goes up, right? That we have a steepening curve, that every year we've delayed, the solutions need to be more ambitious, faster to deploy, more aggressive. So had we started genuinely dealing with the problem in the 70s, when we first understood that it was a problem, we could have had very modest incremental steps that could have been a mixture of just sort of long-range research and good policy and some lifestyle change, and we would have avoided pretty much all of the worst that is yet to come. But now that we've delayed so long, and we are actually in a way sort of still in total delay, even though some things are getting better, some things are getting worse, right? Because of that, the curves we face now are extremely steep and involve disruptive actions, things that are not transitions, but are the abrupt switch from one thing to another, right? So we need to just be shutting coal plants down and building clean energy, for example, right? We need to be reducing transportation emissions by, if necessary, limiting the number of cars that we're driving and how far we're driving and investing in things that aren't just electric vehicles, but in fact are transit and better urbanism and things like this. The solutions that we need now are far more disruptive than the solutions we could have accepted a while back. Part of what that implies is that we have to be looking for solutions that are not only disruptive, but that then give us a better payoff for the kinds of humanitarian goals that we seek, right? That if we want real sustainability to happen, we need not just disruptive sustainability, but increases in prosperity and equity to go along with it. And that's a tough design challenge.
So let's get started. I mean, just to pick on one thing, like let's talk, you mentioned better urbanism. What does better urbanism look like? Where I would start is, you know, let's get rid of single family home, the single family lot. It seems like that's the sort of thing that's incompatible with a greener future full of more prosperity. Or am I overshooting things?
I don't know if you're overshooting things, but let me put it this way. The major goal when you're talking about sustainable urbanism is to deliver a quality of life and a level of prosperity that people seek to have while greatly reducing the climate and ecological footprint of that way of life. That means that most of the time, what we're looking for is demand reduction, right? We're looking to be able to offer something good that requires less demand of energy and materials and services to create. One of the best ways of doing this is to create walkable, compact communities. You know, the evidence is really clear that when you create walkable, compact communities, people's transportation energy use drops dramatically, right? Which is why you can have a city like Atlanta and a city like Barcelona that are roughly equally sized, but Barcelona, with its emphasis on density and pedestrian access and transit, uses about 1/10 of the energy to get around that Atlanta does.
1/10. Wow.
About okay. 1/10. Yeah. Yeah. The question then becomes, what else do we get from that kind of urbanism? And what else could we do to make it even better? One of the things that we know is that when you have access by proximity, right, when the things you want are close enough that you don't need to worry as much about mobility to get what you want in daily life, that you also see reductions overall in consumption. The reasons are complicated, but my favorite example for this is gyms, right? That some people own home gyms, mostly people who live a long way away from a gym and have a lot of space. When you live in a city and maybe you have less space, but also a gym is within a walking distance, owning a home gym is something that only somebody who's really committed to having a home gym would do, right? And so that means that the people who are using the gym that's close by are cutting out the demand for all of the energy and materials and resources and so forth that go into making that home gym, because sharing gym equipment is way less ecologically intensive than owning your own. So just as an example, when you bring people closer together, consumption also drops. When you bring people closer together and you increase the availability of housing, right, you make it easier for people to move into these areas by building more housing, which also makes it more affordable. part of what you're also doing is limiting the pressure on exurban sprawl, right? The pressure that people have to move out into the countryside, to live farther out in the suburbs, that itself is also a reduction in consumption and energy use, right? So when you build compact neighborhoods, you're not just making it easier for people not to own a car. You're actually producing a whole system of benefits that have to do with reducing our ecological impact. The question then is, what can we do to make it better? I see there really being two things. One of them is to think about the design of compact neighborhoods to make them not only more appealing, right? And we know that we can have extremely dense urbanism that's wonderful and that is, you know, attractive because, you know, Americans go by the millions on vacation in extremely dense cities elsewhere, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Paris, for example, London, so forth. But also, how can we make each of the component pieces more sustainable? And this is where things like green design, sustainable design, green building, especially things like passive house standard and other like very ambitious standards come in. Because if you not only have a community that's compact, but all of the pieces of that community are designed to be less energy and material intensive, you get even bigger gains. The last question is really, can we create that at scale? And that's the big battle that I think you were really getting at when you asked about single family housing. Because in order for this to work, we have to make it available to everybody who wants it, right? And right now, we have a situation where cities have these legacies of exclusionary zoning designed originally to keep poor people and people of color out, but now increasingly used simply to suppress housing supply. And that all throughout the Western world, we have these massive housing shortages now. There are very few cities that don't have housing shortages. Some of the cities with the best economic prospects have the greatest housing shortages. And so if we're serious about providing sustainable prosperity, we need to make it accessible and affordable to tens of millions of more people, and then eventually hundreds of millions of more people as cities around the world grow. Again, that's a thing where we might have looked at the design of cities 20 years ago and thought we could do this incrementally, piece by piece. We'll put a mixed use development over there. We'll, you know, think about adding a bike lane over here. But increasingly, we're being forced to consider strategies for rapid urbanization, right? How we build tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of units a year in a metropolitan area, all of which are contributing to sustainable prosperity in order to catch up to where we need to be. And that's a very different conversation.
Tell us about that. When I think of rapid urbanization, I mean, just because of the sort of work that I've done, you know, I'm thinking of informal development, you know, and what do they say? Like, we add a million people a day to cities around the world, and largely in informal structures and slums and favelas and all of this stuff. Where's the future where we're doing that kind of rapid development, but it's being done in a way that's equitable and sustainable and thoughtful? Is that possible with a city that's already been built up?
Yeah. There are two questions there. I think one of them is, how do we envision sustainable prosperity in cities in a way that works for people who are dealing with, you know, extremely constricted situations, right? Who are low income, who may lack stability or even land tenure, who are increasingly at risk from climate disruption, so on and so forth, right? And there's a set of challenges in there that are, you know, as you know, extremely tough to solve from the outside, right? The best we can think to do, if we're assuming that we are people who are living global north lives, the best we can do is seek to accelerate the deployment of solutions for things like clean energy, clean water, you know, sustainable building, and so forth. Because as we build more of these things, they're all on learning curves. And so the more we build, the cheaper they get, right? Just the deployment that we've done in the last decade has meant that now wind and solar are becoming the cheapest energy sources on the planet, simply because we're building more and more of it. We're learning more and more about how to do it. And part of what my book, The Snap Forward, is about, is talking about the need for people who have the ability to deploy these kind of solutions now to do so that we drive the cost down and the availability up everywhere around the world, that we make it possible for people everywhere to be getting the best current sustainability technologies and solutions at low prices where they are. That, combined with really starting to think about how we work in larger systems and larger scales here in the global north, can really drive a lot of change. How we actually deploy a lot more housing, new infrastructure, how we ruggedize against climate impacts, how we take care of people as we move through these really rapid changes is a complicated topic. There's no simple solution. But I would say that the guideline should be that we need to be thinking much more in terms of what do we gain by moving fast and what do we lose by moving slow.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Alex Steffen, but we're going to take a quick break. While we're breaking, check us out on social media, where you can find out more about Alex and his long-storied work. Check us out on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights and on Twitter at Social Design IM. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about speed and how getting change done fast isn't just the preferred option. It's now the only option. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with Alex Steffen about saving the planet, kind of literally, actually. And coming up, we're going to delve into Alex's concept of predatory delay, a fascinating concept. We're also going to talk about Alex's latest book, which I'm really looking forward to. It's called The Snap Forward, no pun intended. It's about hardcore strategies for winning the climate fight. So let's rejoin the conversation and figure all this stuff out. Let's talk about speed for a second, because that's another thing that comes up a lot in your work, that, you know, basically the only way to move at this point is to move fast. And I think I read somewhere in your works a notion of climate gradualism, that, you know, the sort of climate deniers, the sort of fossil fuel industry, this sort of thing, they don't necessarily have to win as much as they just have to delay and delay and delay. And, you know, it evokes a civil rights struggle, right? And the sort of gradualism associated with, you know, equal rights in the United States and all these different things. What is predatory delay? Could you explain that for our audience?
Sure. So the situation we have right now is that we have a number of unsustainable industries that are aware they're unsustainable and that have committed long enough to delay that they now don't really have much of an opportunity to transition into less unsustainable industries, right? So they're increasingly in competition with new competitors, not moving into a new space. For those industries and their investors, the longer they can delay action on things like climate, the longer their profits will continue to flow, the more money they'll make, right? And they're really playing for time against change they know is coming, change they know is inevitable. Because every year they delay, right, hundreds of billions of dollars of profit get made. Of course, they also know that while they're making that money, they're making all of the problems worse. Just as we were talking before about steepening problems, well, they're steepening in part because of the delay of these industries, right? And the impacts on regular people are going up rapidly. The costs we'll pay are going up rapidly, which means that their delay is not just neutral, it's actually predatory. Right? Their profits involve taking money away from other people in the form of risk and cost and damage and death and tragedy. The important thing to understand about this is that they don't win by having the world use fossil fuels in perpetuity, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? No coal company is saying we're going to be using coal in 300 years and being serious about it. Right? They all know that this is a window of time during which we're going to continue using these fossil fuels and doing other high carbon things. And all they have to do is lose slowly in order to make a lot of money, right? So for us, winning slowly is actually the same thing as losing, because in the time it takes, you know, them to lose slowly, we'll have lost a stable climate, we'll have lost the possibility of sustainable prosperity for billions of people, we'll have wound up in a world with tens, if not hundreds of millions of climate refugees, of cities that are spending enormous amounts of money to maintain their simple habitability and structural integrity from rising seas or heat waves or floods. We'll be seeing increased damages from things like famines and civil conflict. If we win slowly, we lose. And so we're in this very difficult situation where what we need is really rapid progress in a way that actually undermines the ability of predatory delay to continue to function. And that means we need to work at scales and at speeds that we're not used to thinking of. And especially, I think, in design discussions, there is a little bit, perhaps, of a, well, of a suspicion of decisions that are made fast and at large scales, and a concern that maybe those decisions aren't reflecting the best interest of everybody, or maybe they're producing unintended consequences, or just maybe this isn't an aesthetically pleasing way to engage with the world, even, right? That the kind of design that emerges is not satisfying to us in certain ways. But we have to really begin to balance that concern for the unintended consequences of large-scale and rapid design decision-making against what we know the known consequences are of failing to make those decisions fast enough to scale the results rapidly.
So there's wolves at the door, and we can't let perfect be the enemy of good, or in this case, planetary survival.
Exactly, exactly. And I think there's actually a really profound challenge that many in the design community are still grappling with, which is how do we take some of the best of the lessons that we learned from the last 15, 20 years of humanitarian design, of user-centered design, of the kind of design thinking that has produced some really great examples of better design that serves communities, that is more holistic, etc. How do we take those lessons and apply them to situations where we are dealing with profound uncertainty and we can't eliminate the uncertainty, right? We have to act at scales that we can't totally predict the outcome of our actions, except that we know they will reduce emissions, they will increase the ruggedization, the capacity of communities to survive disaster. Like, we know they will produce those results, but we can't know all of the unintended consequences. And how do we somehow manage to merge sophistication and design humility with heroic ambition to achieve things that are at the very edge of achievability? I think that's a tension that we need to explore much more creatively.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's something that really holds design back. I mean, both you and I have spent our careers, kind of asking, what design can do, how far can we push this in service of people? And, that attachment to ego, that attachment to knowability really interferes with a lot of solutions, and I find it's difficult for designers just to say, like, hey, look, we're going to do this and we kind of know what needs to get done. And it's not perfect. It may not even be pretty, but this is what needs to get done. So I don't know, man, if you have any ideas, please come visit me at Berkeley, share them with my students.
Okay. I mean, I do think there is something in the question of beauty, which is, I think, part of what we're being forced to do as people who think about design, as people who think about systems, part of what we're being forced to do is to recognize that much, arguably even most, of the design work that's been done in the industrial era, whatever its surface qualities, whatever its aesthetic qualities or its experiential qualities, has a deep ugliness underneath it, which is an ugliness of ongoing, massive, irreversible harm, often done to other people,
yeah,
including future generations. And that so much of what we still call beautiful or well-designed is inflicting ugly, massive costs on others. And we need to figure out how to make design the art of building the beautiful, the genuinely beautiful, not just aesthetically and experientially pleasing, but also systemically beautiful, right? Things that are reducing impacts, that are increasing resilience and ruggedization, and that are also lessening the harm on people and increasing their chance of succeeding. We need to figure out how to do that, right? How to build that beautiful at the scale of the necessary, in the speed, in the time we have left. I mean, that's a big thing, but I do think that beauty is a key part of the equation.
I'm reminded of Bucky Fuller when he said that, when he sets out to design something, he doesn't investigate or attempt to make it beautiful. He attempts to solve a problem. And if at the end he understands that he solved the whole problem, every little bit of it, then he knows his solution was beautiful. And I think I probably mangled it, but you know, the point is, you know, we do have to culturally re-understand what it means for something to be beautiful beyond just the aesthetic object, which is the way we've handled a lot of this stuff for the last couple of decades. Alex, before we break off, I wanted to dig down a little bit into the snap forward, because I am really excited about this book. You know, from some of the stuff you put out online, it sounds like, you know, a lot of the rapid changes we've seen in green consciousness in the last, say, 24 months, you anticipated and sat down and started to write this book about, you know, what happens when, you know, our actions and our consciousness kind of catch up to the realities around us. Tell us a little bit about the book. When did you decide to start writing it? What do we look forward to?
Yeah, so a few years back now, I became very interested in looking at time and looking at the ways in which the passage of time has changed the nature of the problems we're dealing with, as we discussed, you know, just a few minutes ago. Part of what I became more and more aware of is just how defining the speed of our actions is to the outcome we get. If we want to have a world which is non-catastrophic, let alone beautiful and prosperous for billions and so forth, we need to act at speeds that we are not used to acting at, right? Speeds that simply break most of our decision-making processes, that transcend a lot of our political limitations at the moment, etc. One of the questions I started to ask myself is, what can we do in a situation that looks like it is blocked, like it is log-jammed, like there's no way forward, where even the places that are moving very fast are not moving fast enough, and most places are moving slow, in some cases even kind of falling backwards, right? What can we do to change that dynamic? And so this is a book about what it means to understand the world now in such a way that we see the pace of change that's needed, we understand what the roadblocks are and why they're there. For example, predatory delay is a main reason, but also what strategies are then suggested to us by this situation and how we can innovate at the speed we need in ways that tilt the playing field towards action, right? So how we can use creative strategies and better foresight and innovative approaches to actually beat the predatory delay and the sort of denialism that we're encountering in all walks of life. In particular, how we can have a set of professional insurrections in fields like design, where we get people actually producing the kinds of solutions we need in competitive ways that actually disrupt the unsustainable and the irredeemably broken. So it's really a book about how to think about winning the climate fight at the speed we need victory to happen.
Alex, you had me at professional insurrection. I love the love the sound of this. When is it coming out? When can we get a copy?
It'll be out this fall.
Excellent. Keep us posted on the book. We're gonna link to it on our website. And listeners, please check out this book. We'll also link to all of Alex's other books. They're definitely worth reading. If you haven't, get some copies, put them on your shelves, because we are in the fight of our lives. So you could use a good playbook. Alex, thank you again for joining us and sharing all this with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, Alex Steffen, for joining us and sharing with us his vision of rapid and determined change. Alex's work over the years has given us a lot of different ways to think about the future, and like a lot of our guests, I think, makes the idea of change seem palatable, practical, and maybe even exciting. I don't know, I get excited by intractable problems and profound uncertainty, and I'm definitely up for some professional insurrection pretty much at any time. So get on board and learn more about Alex and his work. You can check it out at currystonefoundation.org. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeichner, and at the break, we're listening to Future Games by Fleetwood Mac off of their album, Future Games. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. You can always find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IM. Get your dose of social design impact news anytime, day or night.